Welcome to the Real Estate Dads podcast. We have our guest, Larry R. Martin. Larry has been in the industry since the 70s. He started out building recording studios and was also a musician. He's got some fantastic stories about the 70s and the 80s and losing some big fortunes and making some big fortunes. And to quote Larry, money is a byproduct of a job well done. Welcome to the show, Larry. You know, because we've got you on here now, but we got to learn more about you. And I know some stuff.
Yeah, how I got into real estate was back in 1968, I was a studio musician for a live production company that was in Fresno. I moved up to San Jose and was working in San Francisco for a pretty famous studio. It was His Master's Wheels. And they did people like Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and the Eagles and the Tubes and Everly Brothers and a whole bunch of people. And I was a backup singer and a musician. And it was in the Grateful Dead had built this big, giant, huge studio, but they didn't really finish it. And so we were complaining about the room, a bunch of us. And so we went to work with a bunch of audio engineers and rebuilt the studio. And then after that, we started building other studios around the Bay Area. So, and I built studios. Then I continued Turner's studio in LA and a lot of other studios. I think it's called the Record Plant. And we rebuilt a lot of studios for CBS when they came from wire recorders to tape recorders. And then we built one of the very first where you would link two recorders together, SMPTE time coding. I didn't do it, but some of the engineers that we were working with at the time did that. And Ampex right down the road in Redwood City would give us all the equipment. So we took that on tour and did live recordings, Neil Young harvest albums, did a bunch of Joni Mitchell, and then out live with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, or Crosby, Stills, Nash, and then Young joined them in Chicago, but tours in 1972 and 75, I think, Eagles. So a lot of that. I played with them all, made friends with a bunch of them. And after that, I started doing commercial real estate, building suits in Silicon Valley for people like Apple and Intel, and Nashville Semiconductor, AMD, where we built clean rooms. And I built a bunch of churches. And that takes me right up till, I still am involved somewhat in it.
So for everyone listening, you know, the website LarryRMartin.com, and Larry's got a fantastic, you know, resume written on here that really breaks down year by year, really a plethora of deals that he's developed and gone through. And for anyone listening, you know, we're going to find some more interesting stuff about him regarding his dad life and the work-life balance. But there's a relatively large resume of quite a big accomplishments, you know, the start of it really.
That's just one deal a year, maybe. You know, there's a lot I've done beyond that. So there were star deals for me in the year, maybe, but all over the country. So, and it wasn't so much an accomplishment as an interest. I was more interested in it than anything else. I love my work. I will never quit my work. I'll die with the deal under my feet. And so it kind of started back the late 60s, early 70s. I just have never quit. You know, I've been beat up pretty bad too. I've lost five fortunes. I'm working on my sixth right now. Some of them pretty large. Worst of one was in 2010, delayed reaction to 2008. So I've seen a lot. Which should show on my face.
The signs of wisdom that I hope Trevor and I both have, sorry, continue to get and have more of as the years go on. You know, a lot of these things, you got five fortunes, want to hear more about that, and the dad portion. So where does that come into this?
Yeah, my first wife, my son's mother, she was a big shot in Silicon Valley. And so she had a day job that she couldn't be away from. She was a comptroller for a couple, three pretty large companies. And so she was gone. She would leave at 6 a.m. and not come back until 8 o'clock at night. We held off for 15 years to have children. So our first son was born in 1982. He's 41 now, and he's a rigging contractor and a metal fabricator in Los Angeles, builds high rises and builds staircases and whatever, and it's ornamental gates or whatever. And my second son picked up on the music, and he has several albums out. He lives in Portland. He's an IT guy that works in the background with some special audio software that takes the delay out of phone calls. So if you're calling Europe, you got that 5 seconds, you got to wait for somebody to hear it and then answer you. They take that out. It's kind of magic, the thing they do. They both have families, and they're hunters and fishermen and surfers, and live really nice lives. And each of them has a granddaughter and a grandson, one from each. Yeah, the trials of their lives have come through. My oldest son's wife just died on New Year's Eve from pancreatic cancer that she had for 2 years. And I thought it would destroy my son, but it didn't. He came out much stronger out of all of it. He lived with it all. So everybody's doing well after it. I got an opportunity to talk to her about a week or two before she died, and she was pretty much at peace and settled with it. So that was a family event nobody had ever experienced, you know. But the kids came in, I got to guess that would be, 1983, and I was married 15 years prior to that. So, you know, we were living a life for sure before we had kids. Had a great growing up experience in a really nice old park in downtown San Jose. It was had so many palm trees, they made it a state monument, actually. So all the neighborhood kids, those were wonderful memories back then. So that's how fatherhood came to be. Is that what you asked?
Yeah, we just want to get the lay of the land as we get into this. You got, you know, real estate accolades under your name, but we have these stories, you know, from fathers who share, you know, things on the show with other, you know, people who have had experiences that could match, you know, things that they've gone through, you know, in one way or another. In some ways, it's a little ability to recognize that, you know, people aren't alone in whatever it is that they're going through, whether that's a heavy work life of development projects and deals balancing with kids or dealing with, you know, I'll call it a tragedies in the family of finding out that your first son's wife, which is so unfortunate.
Max, can I take this to left field for just a minute?
Go for it.
Larry, I've been itching to hear a story about the 1960s, man.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Don't ask me why, man, but I want to hear what.
Yeah. Well, there are some negatives to that. I ended up being a drug addict for 16 years out of that. It was a party. It started when I left home when I graduated. I graduated at 17 years old. I moved out. And so going to college, and I thought I wanted to be a bone doctor. And I headed down that road. But then a friend of mine I was playing music. I started playing music when I was 13. And I played with little pickup bands and jam sets. And a friend of mine came to me and asked me if I wouldn't mind coming up and playing in a studio up in Oakland. And so I said, sure, I'll do that. And out of that, I ended up being introduced to it was Wayne's studio band, actually. They needed a 12-string player to get in the middle of that. And I agreed to do that, do some backup vocals. And that band took off. I had an opportunity to go with them, but I was, you know, stage fright was just too much for me, and I couldn't do it. So, you know, the rock and roll days were crazy times. While I was going to college, I'd learned how to drive a semi, an 18-wheeler, and I had a license. They needed a driver to drive the recording truck to the East Coast. And so we joined a tour. It was 1973, I think, Crosby, Stills, and Nash tour. And left San Francisco and had to get into Washington, D.C. We had to be there in like 4 days. So we sent a record crossing the United States. It was written up in Billboard magazine as the fastest cross-country tour truck to that date. Now they do it all the time. You know, we did it in 58 hours, and we broke down for 9 hours outside of Columbia, Ohio. So it was, you were awake the whole time. And these trucks that were built by Hertz, they were 650 horsepower cats, twin turbo cats, real long gears, and you could go 140 miles an hour in those things. And we did pretty regularly. We had a 35-foot furniture van, $3 or $4 million recording board in the back of it, and just drove like maniacs across the United States, and kind of did that for a couple of years. Those are 68 times. I got introduced to a lot of, at the time, cultural things. We were all hippies. I've got great pictures of my hair back. So we were partying and having great times going to college and doing our best to try to get down the road happily. Out of that, I didn't graduate to the real world until, I think, 1978, when I got a real estate license and started doing real estate, you know, commercial real estate, real. So what else do you want to do? 60.
You know, Trevor, that question, you didn't just ask him, how was the 60s? How is it being a musician in the 60s?
Oh, yeah.
Well, everybody could play. And so, you know, there were a lot of people that really had no talent that were top hits because there weren't very many choices. So everybody had a chance to be big. I think the one that the story that I think is, God, I can't remember the name now. He just died too. Came from Florida. They were a Florida local band, and I'll think of his name as I'm telling the story. He came from Florida in a van. They were done playing clubs in Florida, so they drove straight to Hollywood with the money they had for gas, and they got into Hollywood. Didn't have any money to go anywhere, and one of them got out of the truck and went to go make a phone call to a friend, and there was a number written on the wall. That they just, the guy dialed. I guess it had an indication somebody in the music business. And so they, God, what can it, Tom Petty is who I'm talking about. So he's on the phone reading this number that says, you know, recording agent or something, calls up and talks to this guy that hired him on the phone. They were dead busted broke. They're going to have to sleep in the park somewhere and they go beg for food. But that day they pull into California, they get a recording contract. And they do their first album and they're out on tour, you know, right away. And so it was that way in the music business when we were all playing. I played all stringed instruments, a 12 string player and a tenor backup and good harmony and good timing. And so, you know, there were lots of opportunities to play with. I got to play with a bunch of really great names, just, filling in. So it was a lot of fun. And that's coming back now, though. You can see a lot of musicians, you can't make any money with a recording contract. Nobody buys records or recordings anymore. So now what you're seeing are the big expensive concert ticket. And that's how they make their money, is live performances. And so, but they go out on the road and just murder themselves on the road for 18, 20 weeks, twice a year, you know. It's fun, but you got to be young and you don't live that long. I know that my son's mother and I were sitting around. I had just turned 40 and we thought we still had a bunch of friends in the music business. And we decided to count up because we'd heard one of our buddies just died. We wanted to count up the people that had died. And we got to 48 people that had died that we knew in the business. And it was time to change. I had never had any expectation I would live past about 50, 55 years old. So I'm 75 now. I intend to go at least another 20 years. I'm just having too much fun. So that's what it was to play music back then. You know, you could go anywhere and play music. A lot of fun. Definitely a blast.
So let's jump into, Trevor, do you have any, before I jump into dad stories?
No, I'm satisfied.
You're satisfied? Yeah.
I'll tell you plenty more. I got lots of them. You know, we need to sit down for a couple hours. I'll tell you stories all day.
Okay, if you get the more salacious, the better, if you got anything for right now. But, you know, but for our listeners, you know, we've got people who are going through experiences being dads and working life, you know, so, you know, do you have any nuggets of wisdom, you know, from your own experience with your kids, you know, with having you do developments? And how was that when they were growing up and you were going through?
Well, we all learned along the way, and it was a tough learning, I'll tell you that. The most important thing, I think, is to spend time with your kids as much. And I think, actually, that's the second most important thing. The most important thing that I do every time I say goodbye to my kids is I tell them I love you every time, and we don't miss. It was tough early on trying to get through everybody's career and the crazy things that kids do, the stuff that makes you turn gray. In the end, what you really realize when your kids have basically left you, because that's how they grow up. About 13 years old, girl, decide you don't know crap. And at 15 years old, your son's going to challenge you to a fight, you know? And so you got to get through that stuff somehow. So I just worked real hard to try to keep family together the best. We were not really a tight family either. Their mother at the time was gone. She was traveling all over the country doing deals that for her employers and trying to keep up with their businesses. And she wasn't at home that much. It fell on my back. I was a commercial real estate agent at that point in time. And so I stayed at home. I worked from home. I took them to school and then I would go do whatever I needed to around town. But at 3:30, they walk home. Their dad was there and all their friends would come over. And so it's about just being family the best way you can under the circumstances that you live.
Was your house the house that all the kids hung out at?
Yeah. In fact, I was telling the story this morning. Somebody was talking about how expensive kids are to feed these days. Well, the one story I'll tell you, I had left over from my music days. I had a recording studio in the basement, and it was built so the sound wouldn't come in from the outside. It wasn't to keep the sound in, but it worked that way too. So one day I'm upstairs and I'm hearing a lot of noise and go downstairs, open this big door, and a soccer ball hits me right in the middle of the chest, bounces off the TV down there. And I go down, there's 18 kids, like 10 to 13 years old, playing soccer in the basement. Well, when they were done playing soccer, they were eating out of the refrigerator. So we had to go. I had big, huge Sub-Zero refrigerators and freezers that we pack them solid twice a week. And these kids would just eat us out of house and home. It was amazing. So I was the home. All the mothers knew that, oh, hey, Larry's over there. He's at home working. I need to break. I'll send my kid over there. So I was babysitter to the neighborhood. It was a lot of fun. A lot of them were still really great friends of mine, too. I follow them through their lives. So I've had a great time being a neighborhood dad.
That you did some things right.
Not purposefully, I think. Looking back, I don't think I could ever do anything different. It's kept me young, and it keeps me in touch with. I still listen to all their music. If your kids are listening, whatever music they're listening to, I'm listening. It's continued on for me since then. And now they're having kids, and so I'm getting to meet a lot of the kids that were hanging out at my house, 13, 14 years old. They have a batch of kids, and they're going. So it's continued on. It's been just a wonderful life. I can't complain about that portion.
That's fantastic. I mean, there's so much in there. What music are you listening to now?
Well, right now I'm listening to a variety of music. So my partner, my best friend, I'm at her house right now, up in Lake Tahoe, but we trade songs every day. And so I'm listening to whatever it is that fits my emotion at the time. So lots of country and Western. I want to say Gabby Barrett is one of them I just discovered that I think is really good. Enjoy her a lot. I listen to a lot of old times, Randy Newman stuff, because it's fun to listen to. I can't remember all the name, but it's pretty current stuff. And a lot of it goes back 20 years. So I have an iTunes account, and I'm just searching for stuff every day. Listen to at least one album a day.
It's great. And a true artist, listening to the songs match the emotions. So in regards to your real estate career now, what are you doing? I mean, do we have you on here? Website's got a lot of your skills.
Sure. So today I'm doing, I'm teamed up with a guy. We're not partners, but we each have businesses that work together. And so his business is Catamount. He is, Tom Ernst is his name. And he was a C-level managing the underwriting portions of Key Bank west of the Mississippi for a long time. And he also managed an investment group, had 200 investment agents for 15 years. So he does that quite a bit. What I do is I take land. I'm a land man. So I have over the years figured out how to buy a piece of land and take the risk out of it, as much of the risk as possible. And I also know how to spot a market. So I'm looking for properties that, and then tying them up. We have an engineer in-house that does the entitlements. He's a civil engineer. But he does all the entitlements right up to building permits. So all of the horizontal improvement, the street curb gutter utilities are all designed. We'll take that piece to the next level. We're looking right now, I'm looking for GP sponsors that can come in and take the project as soon as you put a shovel in the dirt. We're not good at that. So we want a GP sponsor that knows how to manage properties through disposition, mostly multifamily right now. We want him to get involved in the construction, make sure it gets done so it can be marketed, manage it, and then sell it. And we'll get out of his way. We take an LP position, get out of the way, let him run the show. And our deals are 3 to 7 years. They are all 20% internal rate of return plus a pro rata share of the income throughout. They're all Class A, ground up, 20 to 30 units. We're looking at 100 unit per acre projects in California. Those are the kinds of things. I also have two pieces in Costa Rica that are Pacific side beachfront properties that we control right now. We're looking for money and sponsors for to participate with that. Operators to do two pretty high-end resorts. Got another one up in another resort property I can't tell you too much about up in the Northwest. It's a world destination. Got a piece up there we're working on right now. And I have four projects or 1,250 units of apartments. 600 acres we're working on for, I don't know, 3,000 houses. So that's my current race. I don't know what my partner's doing either. He's always got a surprise for me. So
this is a lot. So you've got a lot of projects. You guys do entitlement work. And for builders who are willing to, who maybe don't want to buy the land, work with you and you'll roll your equity piece and the land value into the deal as an LP. That's really great. So, and you mentioned you have some in-house people. How big is your organization?
The people that we hire and the people that are on board, I think we're at about 10. Somewhere in there. I think I have three and there's seven on the engineering and Tom's underwriting side. We are also creating right now. I'm working with a modular builder. He's been in business for 16 years. We basically, what we're doing, our goal is to provide pipeline for modular manufacturers. So we're working with one that's been in business for 16 years and builds a really nice product. I'll build him a factory, but we get first right of refusal on the pipeline comes out of it. And so we're just providing pipeline for him. A factory can't exist unless you've got 10,000 units committed over 5 years. Otherwise, you just don't even start. You know, it's a $150 million investment. You don't want to go down that path unless you know that you can get to the end. There's been several really big ones that collapsed recently. $860 million gone. They only built one house, you know, and so we're just trying to figure out all of that. We basically are problem solvers and people bring us problems and they turn into projects for us.
Wow. So that's, where's the factory?
There's a factory in Mexico. It's not my factory, but we're going to build him one in Northwestern Nevada, in Fernley, Nevada, which is 8 miles from Tesla and Panasonic and Google and Apple and everybody. It's the biggest industrial park in the world. And we're short housing. You know, 35,000 houses in Fernley, 75,000 in Reno. So plenty to do. And then California is short 4 million houses right over the border. So, you know, I'd like to build houses and FOB them in Nevada, ship them over to California to stack up 100 units per acre.
And you're solving problems.
That's really all there is to do. It's, you know, most people focus. This is my failures come from focusing on the money. You know, if you do a job right, you know, you're going to get paid the money. Money's a byproduct of a job well done. And so I don't focus on the money. It's really about getting the project done. Right now, I don't know what numbers you're hearing for houses we're short in this market, but I'm seeing 14 million in the U.S. And I just talked to a guy in Canada, and they're short 4.5 million up there. You know, so in North America, we're looking at 20 million homes we're short. Not talking about. You know, that's the problem to solve. Keeping up with manufacturing, we're beginning to onshore manufacturing now from China, a lot of spots in Asia. I don't know if it's a blessing or a plague. It looks like we might have a population to do the manual labor, man those factories, and get us back into being a world provider of products.
Yeah, the future is definitely unknown. It's funny, I was going to ask you how many units nationally, if you knew how many we were short. And I think you're absolutely right on demand. You know, the demand is there. We have a ton of people who are newly in the country. And I'm also a massive believer in the inflation story in regards to, you know, the government's, you know, printing of money to a point that, you know, it, both in overseas spending on wars and then in regards to new people who are coming into the country. You know, what it's going to take to get a lot of these individuals stabilized. And there's going to be a lot of government spending as well. Because, you know, there was the number that we were short housing pre-2020. And that number has now grown by a significant amount with, you know, inflation that we've got. Trevor, you got any commentary?
You know, I saw a Facebook post, so it must be true, but something like 80% of the money in circulation right now happened in the last, what came into circulation in the last 2 years.
Yeah, no, you're pretty right. You know, it's increasing too. It's going up. And some of that, you know, I think a lot of it is scare tactic, but actually what it does, just as long as you don't own dollars, it's going to create a lot of wealth anybody that has a stable asset, gold or real estate or, you know, something like that. But bonds are going to do pretty well, I think, too. But, you know, so they can print all the money they want. I don't know if that's good or bad. If we don't catch this economy and kind of control an awful lot of the chaos in this country, I think we're, you know, we have some things to, I just bought 3 guns, you know, and I'm concerned about all that. You know, I did it one time before in the 1970s, you know, when you couldn't buy gas and you're waiting in lines. And,
well, that was some government nonsense, though. That wasn't real. You guys want to see, I want to show you something. Sorry, I mean, I'm happy to talk about the fake fuel crisis that occurred in the 70s. If you know why. But this, you know, this conversation has got me thinking, home prices, and look at what's happening right here. Yeah, can you see this?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm real familiar with that one. I follow that one pretty closely.
All-time high. Home price. This is inflation-adjusted home price index. Like, this was the pandemic boom. This was the recovery from the financial crisis, right? And this curve looks steeper than this one, just not quite as steep. So, that's where the wealth's at, real estate.
So I got some questions in regards to, so tell us about Volcker in regards to, you know, because you've got some experience that, you know, we've read about, you know, we've studied it in school, but, you know, we didn't live through it. So, you know, we've got some high interest right now. How was it back then?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was basically the banks all lied to us. How I lost my biggest fortune was I had 3 projects, and one in North Carolina. Let's see, one in North Carolina. I had one in Spokane, Washington. I had a third one. I had a third one that was also in North Carolina. And what happened was we went in to borrow the money that we needed to do the loan, to do the developments. And I included a land draw, and it included like 80% of the construction cost. And we, you know, we had even worked out a takeout at the end, and all we had to do was build it. And what happened was the banks that we borrowed from, all three of the, well, two of them were community banks. They had overlent beyond their approved lending capacity by FDIC. So FDIC came in and closed down the bank on a Saturday, or, you know, that Saturday afternoon, they closed it down. And the very next, on Monday, then they told us all, you got to repay your loan in 30 days. They took all our money, and, you know, I had $10 million in bank and 2 different banks. They took all the cash out of the bank, out of my accounts that we're going to, you know, buy the land and build the buildings, and then demanded that we pay back the balance of the loan. And we didn't have any ability to do that. And the projects were worth nothing when that happened. So you couldn't sell them.
They called the money due, but they didn't have a clause that allowed them to call the money due, but they did it anyway.
Yeah. Well, it's FDIC. They can come in and shut down your local bank if they insure it, and you get 6-1. At that point, I was 40-1. You could go to the Fed window, and if you had $1 in deposits, you could borrow $40. And the banks that we were working with, apparently went in beyond $40, the 40, 50 bucks for the dollar. They had borrowed too much to be safe, to be solvent in the eyes of the FDIC. And they can come in and shut you down right now. They open back up and they do business, but they do it. They run the bank, and then they try to find an operator within the community to take over the, you know, all the REOs that you see get taken, those are taken at the ratio they're taken, but they're valued on bank books at the ratio that they borrow at right now, 6-1. So they have $1 in, you know, and so you can literally go in and buy an REO for 1/6 of whatever it was paid for it. And that's what happened back then too. So the third one was Lehman Brothers. They were the sacrificial lamb. National lenders, they were the guys that suffered the most. And so anybody that had any loans with them also went belly up. I can, you know, the horror stories are way worse than they are now back then.
No, it's nuts. For context, so that's a 2.5% reserve requirement back then, which like goes a long way to explain the stagflation that was going on. Right now, we're at 14%. So 7-1 versus 40-1.
Yeah. See, that's gone up too.
It was less.
And I think we're starting to head down that path again where, you know, back in the mid 80s, it was 7-1 too. But as soon as Silicon Valley started taking off and some of the real estate markets started to take off in the early 90s, you know, they start ramping up the ratio to back to 2.5-1. You know, I think we're heading that direction. I think we need to pay attention to that a lot. One of the good things is really short housing. That's a good thing. From the perspective of solvency. Right now, you can't sell a house, but you can sure rent it. One of our plans is to go to the HR departments at the local industrial park and tell them we've got housing for your engineers you hired that you want to move in here. They can't buy a house. So, you know, and that's what we're doing. And I think the rest of the nation do an awful lot of the same thing. Kind of a different... Feels the same a little bit, but it's different. The causes are quite a bit different, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So, and when the interest rates spiked with Volcker, you know, how was conducting business at that time? Because you talked about the loss of fortunes, but right now there's a lot of people who are trying to make sense of deals and they're going, hey, you know what? Interest rates have moved up. And for a lot of people who are in the industry for, you know, I'll call it even the last 20 years, they've never seen interest rates this high. And, you know, when I look at the rates and I go, you know, historically, I just know from school that, you know, they were higher at a previous point. But it, you know, but a lot of guys are having trouble making sense of deals in today's world. How was it when rates were up in the high teens?
Well, they weren't just in the high teens. I remember doing deals at 23%. I think 17% was not unusual at all. And I think that created the land prices just collapsed. And buildings were... There were situations where you couldn't fill a building up. And I can remember a really big contractor. There were two brothers. One was a developer and the other one was a commercial contractor who built the buildings for his brother. And he had, I can't remember the number of buildings, but they were all really large R&D buildings located in North San Jose. And he hadn't started them. And the bank said, take the money out, build the buildings. They weren't going to let him off the hook. And so he built the buildings knowing he could never lease them. Well, he went belly up and the bank took the buildings that now had at least an asset value about equal to the money they lent. And again, the ratios made it possible for the banks to make money. But my buddy went broke. He's belly up. He's never been back to the construction business again. And his brother barely survived, you know.
So how did people make money? Like, how did you make money in that environment, in real estate?
Well, yes. Well, actually, you were wraparounds and all kinds of things were going on then where you could at least get a margin in a deal and you didn't hang on to a deal long. You didn't borrow the money unless you knew you could finish. If you were stuck in like a variable rate loan, you were stuck in a deal. A construction deal and you were going to start construction and all of a sudden your loan went from 6% to 12 or 14. You know, I had to eat that. You had to figure out how to make it work. There was a lot of effort put into losing money.
And I've got an economic question here coming up, but first one that, you know, I wanted to ask, you said you had some of these development partners who just didn't make it back. They just said, hey, you know, I'm out, but you didn't do that. You actually said that you lost fortunes 5 times, but you have not allowed these occurrences to stop you. And, you know, let's hear a little bit about that. Let's hear about some mindset because, you know, there's clearly other people who just threw the towel and said, hey, this is now failure. You did not do that. So please.
Yeah. You know, for a long time, I said, let's get in trouble and we'll work our way out of it. You know, and that's part of it, being stupid. Yeah. But that's the quickest way to learn, I think, to make mistakes where you get injured a little bit and then you remember the injury. I really thrive on solving problems. And no matter what the problem is, I like to just dive into it as deep as I can. Didn't have a lot of consciousness about what I was taking on. I didn't know that. So it was ignorance probably more than anything else. And so what I've learned to do is be an expert in areas. So I follow markets. I drive 40, 60,000 miles a year, burn down cars pretty regularly. I want to go drive a market. I want to shake the hand of the guy I'm going to do business with. And I want to know a market really as deeply as I can. So I follow several publications daily that tell me about the marketplace. I'm also working with some people that are, these are new technologies that you're going to find AI is bringing about. One I can tell you about is that it's a production monitoring software or program that in a module, any factory, any production factory, any point in time along the production, you could do it 6-12 times a day. It'll tell you if you're ahead or behind. So you're losing money or making money any point in time. This software will tell you that just based upon its ability to measure all the different variables in the production process. And the reason that that's important is modular factories go broke in a day and can't recover from it ever. And so it's important to be able to pay attention to what you're doing and make changes to try to stay above the red line as much as you can. The efficiencies of all of that is what's going to get us out of these problems now. Modular saves you 30 to 70% of the construction time on site. It's built in the factory and delivered to the site once it gets there. Once an order comes in for a house, we want it to be occupied 90 days. I don't know. You can, stick fill can't do that. Can't do that in 9 months.
And help us out with modular. So this is not a mobile home, but this is a...
It's better quality than stick built. And it's a 100-year product because it's all commercial thin steel studs and real current technology materials for exteriors and things. Then, so all of the wood goes into the making the inside beautiful. It doesn't go into trying to hold it up and also turn into black mold and termites and whatever else it does. And so the quality of the product, plus it's precision. So you can stack them up like Legos, and hook them all together. And they look just like stick built, but they get done in 40% of the time, which takes you out of exposure, change the market. There's plenty of projects. The one that I cite that my biggest one that I lost on was the one that Lehman Brothers was going to fund. We had been working on that project for 2.5 or 3 years. And at the time we started, the market was great. But when we lost our ass, the market was bad. That's what happened here with the bridge loans just not too long ago. Guys got in too early and found out now they can't recover from it. So that happens a lot in construction. So markets can't change on you. For a lot of reasons, modular is that really the future of availability of housing and probably a lot of commercial properties too. We just can't catch up. We don't have the workers anymore. You try to hire a carpenter for anything less than $28-$40 an hour. Just doesn't happen. So, and they're not available anyway.
That's very accurate. We find that constantly. We've got repair guys. It's always a big task.
So, Trevor, I've got another question for him. I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah, I do. So what about the resale value of a modular home compared to a stick built? Is that comparable? A follow-up question to that, if someone wants to sell their modularly built home, does the buyer have any trouble with financing, or is it all the same as a stick built?
No, everything is, they are all financeable. They qualify for FHA, but conventional, all of it. It's the same quality as stick built. It's just done in a factory and assembled on site. If you ever saw one, you're not going to be able to tell the difference between a stick built and a modular. The company that I work with, this is a great company. You might want to check them out. It's Devel, D-V-E-L-E, Daniel Victor Edward Larry Edward .com. And they build the finest quality house I have ever walked through. And it's about $750 a foot, but it compares to $1,500 of custom builds all day long. They're fabulous homes. Plus, they're off the grid. Their automations are installed in them. So your wife is driving down the road on a snowy day and 500 feet from your garage, the garage door opens for her. And when she gets out, the garage door closed. All of the automations go on in the house, and so it becomes livable automatically. So you program the house you're going to live in. Plus, you've got one less energy bill to pay. So we're kind of heading off in technologies like that that are going to make life a whole lot better to live in. We're learning how to do things like make a room usable for two different uses with pieces of furniture that you can move back and forth that will create different spaces. So you can make 800 feet feel like 1,200 feet. trying to get to a place where it's good and comfortable, good 10-foot or 9.5-foot clear height ceilings, an 800-square-foot house or unit, you think you're living in something almost twice that size. A lot of new developments coming on. I think they're easier to sell and resell. So we have to prove that. But one of the worst reputations that they have is they're compared to manufactured, which is basically, those are motor vehicles. They're built on rails and come on axles.
Yeah, they're trailers that convert to real property by going through a...
Well, you can't, you have to permanently attach them to make them real property. So it's still personal property until you put them on a foundation. I know Nevada won't let you bring in a manufactured home unless you put it on a perimeter foundation. So I don't want to, I don't want to see, you know, single double wides aluminum sided, you know, they don't want to see that. Nobody wants.
So in regards to going back to, I'll call it the history of business, you had, what year was it that you had that 23% loan?
Oh God, that was early in my career. It would have been 78, 75.
And how was it when you got to the raging 80s? Like, how was it in those...
Or transition from kind of this.
Yeah, we got loans got down to about 9%. You know, people are screaming and yelling at 8.5% and 7%. And, you know, I had home loans for 9.5%, you know. So I think it's, you learn to live with what you learn to live with. Everybody needs to go out and make enough money to live. That's not happening these days. You know, a lot of folks are just expecting you to lay around and expect money to be handed to them. It was COVID really changed our entire climate. You know, it got everybody to stay in their houses and with a big screen TV and the food delivery service raged right then. And so they could stay in there with all their kids watching big screen TV and get food delivered to them at the door, and the government would pay for it. Well, we got a long way to go to get out from underneath that. Just think about your kids and whether they got re-educated for 2 years or not. You know, my kids went to every day of school, and COVID kids missed 2 years, maybe more. And so we're creating a problem 20 years. My sister was an ex. She took care of or managed 200 social service agents, I guess you could call them, down in San Bernardino County. And she says this problem is going to be with us for at least 3 generations.
Yeah, I guess they could see that you end up with a child of the COVID and grows up to raise their child a bit differently, and then another, and then their kids also have that. Yeah, I mean, I could see the same thing. I mean, it's in some ways how a lot of us, you know, my dad was a Depression era kid. His dad was in the Second World War, and you know, and that they just grew up penny pinching everything. That was just how his whole family was. You know, and I definitely recognize how, you know, I grew up as a result of coming from someone who came from that environment, and my wife has, you know, similar stories about that kind of thing. So yeah, that's an interesting take for sure, that the COVID is going to be something that's going to be with us for so long. I hadn't really considered that, but you're right, it really will.
It's already kind of here, you know, all this online stuff happening right now between the three of us.
Yeah, there's a bunch of scare going on, you know, that I think is unmerited. I like being out and adventuring and having a great time. A little concerned now about it. There's a lot of people in this country who don't know anything about. I'm concerned about that a little bit. You know, I think that there's a generation, the youngsters in that generation have become attuned to not venturing out, to staying inside and isolating themselves from the rest of the community. You know, I think that's an issue.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I've noticed quite a bit when I see a lot of the kids today or a lot of millennials who have certain traits that came from their parents. And then, you know, my generation was a lot more of the free range parenting. You know, my parents, I grew up in the 80s, and that was a time where, you know, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't know where we were. You know, there was, you know, you hear people talk about this kind of stuff, but that's such a weird thing to think about now when you call someone, say, hey, where are you? You didn't ask that up until someone had a cell phone. You always knew where they were. They were at wherever the phone, you had to answer the phone. You know, and that's just such a difference in, you know, this way that people are, you know, engaging with their kids. And I even think about it with my son, where we have his baby cam. You know, when we were kids, there weren't baby cams. There might have been the walkie talkie, you know, where maybe there was no walkie talkie. And, you know, my wife and I are like, well, when do we take the camera out of his room? And I kind of had this, well, wait a minute. I don't even know if I want him having this mindset that he's always on camera. that he makes a immediately run in, you know, is that something that we shouldn't be doing even, you know, right now? And then I have the same thought of wondering, you know, at what point is it that, you know, we have this generation of kids now who have this mindset that they're always on camera, whether it's their phone or whether it's a security camera somewhere or it's a baby cam. And that's something that I think about, you know, quite a bit in regards to, you know, kind of what you're just touching on, changing nature of parenting in general and how that is affected by, you know, whatever's going on in popular culture. Trevor, you have any thoughts?
I'm not too terribly worried about it. You know, like these kids, it's like every generation looks at the generation that comes after them and they're like, what the hell are you doing? And the younger generation looks at the last generation is like, what the hell were you doing? I think it's mostly that. And, you know, I'm an optimist, man. You know, the thing I've noticed about society, like really just any study of history, is things actually tend to get better with, from one generation to the next. Like everything really does.
Yeah, hopefully. I also have that same, we've talked about this on a couple times on the podcast where, you know, I've got a faith in humanity that things will, you know, continue to, people will band together during hard times. You know, there are a lot of the things you mentioned regarding a lot of people in the country that we don't know who they are. And yeah, that's a pretty, you know, common concern I think a lot of us have. And I, you know, I come back to, you know,
always has been for every generation.
Which part?
You know, pointing fingers at immigrants and being like, every country for as long, far back as history is recorded, there's some group that has a problem with a new group, right? Some old group's got a problem with a new group.
Yeah. You know, and I'm not so, I think the majority of them are just people that want to have a better life and that what better place to come to. We just have to find a place for them. I don't know how you're never going to, you can't ship them out. Anybody that says you're going to send them back is joking. There's no chance that's going to happen. You know, if you could ferret out the ones that are really bad for us and get rid of them, I think the rest of them will do just fine. That's what this country is about.
I completely agree with you. I still have belief in the American dream. You know, Sherpa, we were talking about this, you know, on another podcast, we're talking about, you know, open borders and having it be fair markets. I am pro people getting a better life and getting to a location where they can work and have it be rewarded, you know, having work and then have a result be that they did something and they were able to get, you know, accomplishment that benefited society, hopefully benefited everybody. And I think a lot of the pull right now with, you know, the immigration is what's going on within our current politics of cost in regards to managing, because we don't really have a free, we don't have that sense of having everyone come in and then just have this ability to start working and have it not be in some way a massive shift for the existing people, whether it's in taxes or whether it's in lack of housing or those other things. So, and because I don't want to have any commentary regarding the people who shouldn't have the right to be able to work hard or have a safe place to live. You know, those aren't things that I'm against. But I think the most of it comes into, you know, how does our current government that is right now very tax heavy and not necessarily a group that I think a lot of us are happy with how taxes are spending, you know, account for assisting in either making this process of these people that are here now be something that's, you know, a benefit and not just another tax. And I go back to this on several fronts. You know, I several times in my life have been, you know, on liberal topics, but I've gotten to the point where I just get concerned about the government spending the money right. And I lost some faith in them spending the money right, where I go, you know, I want to pay my fair share of taxes and have, you know, our country working well, but I'm always not necessarily sure that I'm in agreement. And that's not even on a liberal basis. That's on liberal or Republican or you know, and I'm like relatively against our two-party system. But that's been something that I've just kind of been thinking about where, you know, is it the fact that there's people coming in or is it the fact that our current administration or any administration?
It's always the government's fault.
And administration is not going to handle it the way that, you know, we hope would be something that would benefit everybody.
They tell us it's our fault. That's what they, or it's their fault. They tell us it's their fault. And if you vote for me, I'll fix them. Right. And everyone believes that crap, but it's their faults.
It's funny when I think back when I was a kid and we had, you know, little elections and it was pizza parties. I'm for more pizza parties. I'm for less homework. I'm for more days off school.
Yeah.
Nothing's changed.
Yeah. That is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I lived that way.
Yeah.
Lived most of my life that way, best they could, you know? Yeah. Can't wear Levi's, it isn't worth doing, you know?
So Larry, you know, we've covered a lot of topics on this and you've given us some advice on, you know, telling your kids you love them, creating a good household where the kids can interact and, you know, being, you know, both a working dad and a stay-at-home dad to some regard. You've been through some major eras within the last, you said you're 76?
75, just turned 75, November 29th.
So you turned 75, Ian, you've had so much more wisdom than a lot of our guests. You know, we've had some young dads, we've had a couple of guys who have some grandkids, you know, but I think the wealth of knowledge that you shared with us regarding, you know, kind of some high interest rates and coming back from
losing all your money five times. I mean, my God.
And still trucking and still doing more new big deals, and not just big deals, but cutting it technology deals in the real estate industry, which is a bit antiquated, you know, which is, you know, really great to hear.
Sure. You know, the construction industry goes back to the late 1700s. Hasn't changed much since then, you know? It's sawed lumber and nails put together with some kind of covering on the outside and on the roof, you know? And so we have a ton of new materials, wonderful technology that's available to us. I'm in a circle on LinkedIn. It's probably, I don't know, maybe 300 that have come from the construction industry over decades, educators that are and scientists that are trying to study, problem solve all these things, that are all talking a lot about how you get the efficiency into a construction of any kind. In stick-built outdoor construction, there are too many unknowns that limit it. So, you know, it's a new world. It truly is. It's like when personal computers came around. So that was a big change. I had my first PC in 1972, and nobody had it, and there was no internet.
What's holding back the modular, the growth of the modular industry? Because I mean, by all appearances, it is not as popular or ubiquitous as stick-built. What is holding it back?
Pride, for the most part, I think, and denial. A bad reputation that manufactured housing is. All the single wides in South Carolina have made a reputation for modular. The guys that I'm working with want me to go find a bunch of lots in downtown Reno or around in Reno so they can put them up so people can go see them. You know, they are fabulous homes.
I think it's going to be a changing of the guard type situation, personally. I think the technology is getting better, and I think there's going to be a wave.
I mean, in some ways, you know, I mean, if you've been in the industry at all, hey, that's a 60s build. That's a 70s bill. That's an 80s bill. That one was a 90s. This one was early 2000s. You know, and you, I mean, you can walk into a unit. I can tell by the cabinet boxes. You know, if they're original, I can tell you what year the building was built. I can tell you by the thickness of the countertops, whether it's quartz or granite, whether it's got a curved edge or a straight edge, or if it's an inch versus thin. I can tell you what year it's built by walking into most of these places. And someday, you know, right now, a lot of it's been the build to rent. That's going to be the one people are going to go, oh, it's a build to rent project. That was, you know, of the 2020s. And it might be 2030s where people look back and go, that was a modular build, you know, from that company that had that particular style, you know, whatever it was for multifamily, which, you know, it'll be interesting. But, you know, once the big articles come out showing that some developer made a 20 or 30 IRR, I mean, you're doing 20 IRRs on your current modular builds or on?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I don't get involved in that building, any of the construction or erection of those, and I don't manage any of that stuff. And so, I'm done when a shovel goes in the ground, and we'll take whatever profits. We'll stay in a deal. We're not going to rob the profit of assets and create a bigger loan. We'll stay in the deal and let some guy, a GP sponsor, knows how to manage a project like that, take it over. Right now, I think the bridge to ownership is rental. So you still have to build a single family house that can sell to somebody that wants to move into it. As soon as financing gets itself squared away. So, you know, I think over the long run, I think the quality of house you're going to get, I think it's going to be like the car industry. You got six models and three different upgrades of them. That's it. And if you want something different than that, then go pay whatever you have to pay for a stick builder to do it for you. And I think that's the way it's going. And a lot of there's been several huge failures, factory failures, just recently. So you got to figure out, developers need to be manufacturers, and manufacturers need to be developers, so that you got a pipeline, so you can assure that factory's going to make it. Once you put a crew in there, you don't ever want them to leave, and so you got to keep them busy the whole time. I think that's part of the problem. It's all young guys doing it now, too. Talking to a bunch of young couple. I knew a young couple in Texas that is building their own factory to supply the housing for their own development. And they're going to be successful. They're using all real high technology, and they only need to produce 10 or 15 homes, but they're going to learn how to produce 20 by doing it. They're in the small, it's too small a building, but I know that when it comes time to ramp it up, they'll go get a bigger one. I know the plants I'm working on are 400,000 square feet and they're $150 million.
Yeah.
So you got to have a pipeline and you got to create the housing. Well, I think the housing will get absorbed, but either in rental or sales, but not sales for another 8 to 18 months, I think. Interest rates or some form of financing, either tax rebates or I don't know what it is. I know there's a bunch of guys trying to figure it out right now. So we're getting there.
We are getting there.
Larry, I got a question for you, man.
Sure.
When you get into a deal, you're acquiring the land all cash, I take it, right? And then...
Oh, actually, no, my deal goes, I'll give you... A guy wants me to pay a fortune for a piece of land. My line to him is, I'm happy to take it under contract, and I'm going to give you a deposit check, but that check's going to be made out to a title company. You're not going to cap it until I remove the contingencies on this, and I'm going to get a 90-day free look before I give you a check. If you want me to buy this piece of land, you got to give me the time and incentive to spend the money to make it worth what you're asking. And that's really the problem with land right now is everybody thinks they've got goals when what they've really got is coal. And so you got to let me turn that coal into diamonds or gold and before I can pay you the price that you want for it. When we get there, we're about 90% sure that we can get the entitlements done. And since everything is in-house and we're starting on finding out what the local government's saying inside that 90 days, we're going to get a good feeling for it, at least an 80% feeling for it before I'll really spend the money. It costs anymore. Well, just our underwriting for a project costs minimum $20,000 to as much as $150,000. And then you know what your project can do for you. And then after that, there's engineering. It's $500,000. And then entitlements and construction drawings is another $700,000. So you're deep into a piece of land before you close
the escrow. Wow. Not a speck of, no shovel movement yet.
Yeah. No, we haven't even stuck a shovel in the dirt yet. Yeah. And that's where the big danger comes. If you stick a shovel in the dirt with a short market, you're going to get stuck with empty buildings. So these are all failures of mine that I'm describing. So I write my contracts in a way that I'm never going to fail again. And if I can't have that deal, it's next. I got to move on to the next piece of land. I got to be working. You know, I'll do my best to pay your price, but you can't hobble me in trying to make sure that I'm safe in trying to do my best.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. As we all learn, you know, you can't push your numbers. They are what they are.
Yeah, big contingencies. And be conservative, you know. Everybody's telling you $350 a foot to build. Make it, add 10-15% contingency on that, make it 400 and live with that number, make that number work and make it have a good return for your investors. You know, and in my business, if investors get paid back first and they get paid back with their entitled, their priority payment first before we take any of our profit. You know, I come from a handshake business. You can't do anymore. We try to put that same ethic back in the business. And I'm beginning to see a lot of young guys are doing the same thing.
I do a lot of business on Handshake. A lot.
It's worth it. And then you build the best relationships that way. You know, you want to repeat them.
And that's one thing I love about real estate in general is that you've got this community win. And, you know, and some of my closest friends are people who we've done deals with because we all were in the trenches together, got a paycheck, did a big accomplishment. And, you know, as a result, there's a lot of ease to do more business together. And, you know, a lot of people, I had one guy say this to me years ago, but, you know, I sent him a CA on something and he kind of went, dude, this is the fastest way to not get engagement.
Yeah.
Because they had the CA and the CA, the company that I sent it to, they had to send it to an attorney. The attorney didn't want to review CA just because they were this big organization. And he went, look, if you do that, you're just going to shut it down right away. And he was totally right. And I went, you know, if you want to make things happen, you got to do handshake deals and make business happen. Anyway.
Well, that's how they start. You know, I'm working on a handshake right now with Devel, but we all know we all want to get something out of it. And I think we're at the spot now after a year and a half of working together where we're actually going to draw some kind of an agreement. And I'm not saying that's the safest or best way to do it. But when you start to spend the money, then you have to consider what your attorney can defend you in, you know, in court. And it's unfortunate that that's that way, but that's never been any different that I can see. The guys I learned. That's how they were. No different.
So, Larry, we've had some great pieces of wisdom from you. Where can listeners get in contact with you?
Oh, well, you could go to LarryRMartin.com and take a look there. I think that's probably the best way to get in touch with me. There's lots of connections in there. I have my phone number is really a good one. I don't answer phone calls unless I know who's calling me. So if you call me and leave a message, leave your phone number and your email and your name, I'll put you in my book. And anytime you call me after that, if I see it, your call come up, I'll answer it. And if I miss it, I'll put you top of the list and call you right back. And I love to talk. I love to love these opportunities to meet people. I always learn something in every conversation. So don't be hesitant. Please be in touch. Right now, I'm working with Raise Masters, and so that's a crew that nice little network. A lot of folks there. So if you're a Raise Master or another one, you can reach me there. In LinkedIn, spend a lot of time in LinkedIn as Larry R. Martin, and follow me, and I'll follow you back, and I'll make sure I contact you and send you a note. Absolutely, invite you to connect.
I'm so glad that we've had you on. You know, another place to we'll have Larry's contact is on the Real Estate Dads podcast website, where you can get in contact with all of our guests, as well as access to our Slack channel, where we've got a connection market for our guests and listeners who want to connect with other real estate dads. And Larry, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate the wisdom. You know, not many people are willing to share their stories. And I want to thank you for doing that, because there's a lot of people out there that can get a lot from this. People who've been through a lot of these different ups and downs in careers, and you know, at some different point. And, you know, I think that, you know, you overcoming the five hardships financially, I think is one that really resonates with a lot of people in today's market, because there's a lot of guys really scratching their head going, you know, where are things going to go?